Today.
Today.
At the edge of our hope. At the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other.
Today there is not a man or woman in here that shall stand alone.
Not today.
Today we face the monsters that are at our door and bring a fight to them. Today we are cancelling the apocalypse.
The single greatest talk radio host who has ever lived. Well, he might not be that great, but he's still pretty awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show, where the only thing worse than the truth is Vinny's jokes.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show. In the spasmodic vibration sense of the word episode. But the other thing that I wanted to welcome you to, ladies and gentlemen, is a new world order. You know, just welcome it, ladies and gentlemen.
Don't fight it. Just listen to people talk about it endlessly. You know, don't like put your boots on the ground and go, hey, I've got a personal responsibility here. I'm going to do something about it. Don't do that.
No. Sit back. Tell all the people that are fighting it on your behalf that they're doing a good job and to keep up the good work and don't donate them any money. You know, I'm sure that'll prevent these ruthless criminal sociopaths who've got tantamount control of the world and are going to make it even worse progressively each second that we don't resist. I'm sure that'll just make them all just bow down and go down to nothing, right? And here's the thing. The reason why I say this, ladies and gentlemen, is not to poo-poo you, is not to belittle you, is not to say I'm ungrateful for your thanks, your support, and your growth, and that kind of thing. It's actually more to thank the people who have tuned out of the show over the years because they've started their own show, or they've tuned out of it because they started inventing something. They tuned out of the show because they started up a community group and it's just taking too much of their time and they can't devote the time that is necessary to know what's going on in other people's lives and other people's shows and things like that because they're living their own life. That is the goal of this show, ladies and gentlemen, not to just get you to keep listening. And if you are already living your own life and you do spend some of that time listening to this show anyway, then I'm especially grateful. My very special guest today, did I say guest? Guest, without an R, is Greg Catton. And I'm not sure if that's exactly how you pronounce it, but that's how I'm going to do it because I've got a funny accent. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And yes, it is Greg Catton. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, Greg, ladies and gentlemen, is the author of the book, The Joys of Psychopathocracy. And he's been talking about how the governments of the world essentially follow a psychopathic mindset. You know, if you have any familiarity with the concept of psychopathy, controlling, no responsibility, ruthless, damaging, and that kind of thing. So you apply that towards a governmental scale. And what you've got here, ladies and gentlemen, is essentially a path to destruction that is global in nature. Right. So if you understand this concept of psychopathy, you understand the most destructive individuals on earth. And if you understand the concept of psychopathocracy, then you understand how the earth is truly run. So, Greg, again, welcome. Would you just give us a little bit of background on yourself and who you are and what it is you do?
Well, I'm an American herbalist. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and for the last 20 years or so that I was in the States, actually 23 years, I lived in Louisiana, and I came upon a cure for cancer, a legitimate cure for cancer, which had been secretly and privately been used for hundreds of years. I've documented this very extensively in an online book called Metatopia. It's a free read at metatopia.org. And my travails, or I guess depending on how you look at it, my familiarity with just how over the top insanely criminal and evil the U.S. government was, came after a raid in 2003. At the end of which, or the end of 8 months, at which they said, "We've got all these papers we need you to sign. And by the way, this is a plea deal. And if you don't accept it, we're going to go after your wife." At which point I said, "You're going to go after my wife for what?" And they said, "Don't you worry. We'll find something." You know, it just, there was no end to just how perversely evil the things that I encountered were. Subsequent to that, I had a stint in prison because I wasn't going to have them go after my wife or kidnap my 7-year-old son. I had to hide my son in a farmhouse. I mean, you wouldn't believe what I went through. I had to hide my son because I hadn't given advance warning that they were going to take him, kidnap him, put him into social services, because at that point they could say I was unfit father. I mean, insane, the insane things that I learned. So I made a decision when I got free of these people in 2007, I was going to leave the country. So in 2007, I moved to where things got really, really, really crazy is that in 2009, I get it from a customer saying, "Are you realize you're in Parade Magazine? You're in every major newspaper in the United States. You're listed as one of the 10 most wanted criminals in the whole world." I said, "This is a joke, right? You've got to be pulling my leg." And he said, no. "Who are the world's most wanted?" And you can see there a picture of me with Osama bin Laden. I'm pictured all over the United States with Osama bin Laden as one of the world's most wanted criminals. Well, then they had me on the Interpol red list. Subsequent to that, it was shown everything that they said about me was not true. Because to these governments, truth has no meaning in the world. They just make up whatever they want to make up. The truth has no meaning. Law has no meaning. Nothing has any meaning other than just whatever short-term political objective that they have. And so that was a huge learning experience for me. So all these things contributed to the creation of this book because, of course, when you go through the kind of things that I go through, you wonder, is every government on earth criminally insane, or is it just the United States? Is the United States the only country in the world where you've got the people who are the most psychopathic individuals that the imagination can conjure? Those are the people in power. Those are the people who run your planet. Those are the people in charge. And I came to the conclusion, no, this is systemic. It varies from country to country to some degree, but basically you have structures in place, social structures in place, artificial constructs in place that ensure that the most criminal-minded individuals ascend to the very top of the power pyramid. And then you have to ask yourself, well, how did it get to be this way, and is there a way that this can be corrected? And so that led to a very long journey, and I had this major epiphany. This is kind of the linchpin upon which the book revolves. I had this epiphany while I was in prison, Stone Age Economics by American anthropologist Marshall Solon, who came up with this idea that human relationships are like concentric circles. The very center of human relationships, you have pure love, the relationship that a mother feels for a child. You have interfamily connections where people do things for each other, not because they're looking to make a buck, not because they're looking for a one-upmanship, not because they're looking to take advantage or get opportunity. People do things for each other because they live in a natural state of love and affection. And if you've had as many ayahuasca journeys as I've had, you realize that the fabric of the entire, this is the fabric of the entire universe. The mortar that fills the bricks that constitute your universe is this energy that we call love. I mean, when you have entheogenic journeys, in the Amazon, as many as I have, you can actually see the interplay between protons and electrons. And in a mechanistic system that views physics as strictly devoid of perception of higher things, they see it as all mechanical. It's not. There's actually a certain kind of love and affection, even on a subatomic level. From this is where that great famous poem comes from, Walt Whitman. "I am he who aches with amorous love. Does the earth not gravitate? Does not all matter attract all matter? So the body of me to all I know or me." Famous poem by Walt Whitman. So once you leave that, that nice warm feeling that we have within our families, the first between mother and child, and then between killed and their parents. Then you leave there and you go to the tribal sector, the village sector, and lineage sector. You start to go away from the center. And the farther you go away from the center, the more diluted that is. So you have forms of reciprocity for which you're not expecting something immediate return, but you know that if you give to others around you and they benefit from it, they will do something for you in return. So there's kind of a anticipated return. We all do things where we're helping someone else. We don't give us anything or to pay us, but we know that if we do enough good things in this world, that somehow the universe will respond in kind. What I found incredibly interesting, and here's where my enlightenment came from. This is where my epiphany came from. He stops at this edge. He won't go beyond it. The anthropologist, Marshall, won't go beyond this. He won't go beyond the zone of reciprocity into what he calls negative reciprocity. I shorten it, create a new word in English. I call it negaprocity. This idea that I exist in this world to take advantage of you. You and I are going to interact in some way. And my objective is to make sure that in my transacting with you, I'm the winner and you're the loser. I traded something with you. We interacted in some way. But in the transaction, I'm not thinking of your interests. I don't have any empathy. I don't have any compassion. I just want to win. I'm out to screw you. That is negative reciprocity. And then when you look at what the structures that surround your life, be it small governments, regional governments, the banking system, the major corporations, you can actually create where you put them all in their proper place. Now, compare this to a house. I don't have to tell any of your readers that if they own a house, where do you put the refrigerator? Well, you know where it goes. It goes in the kitchen. Where do you put the dining room table? It goes in the dining room. Where does you put the bed? You put the probably in the bedroom. You probably put the beds in the bedroom. Okay. So people don't need any education. They don't get a three-unit course in university or college telling them, where do you put your furniture and appliances? Where do you put them in your house? Almost intuitively, everybody knows where everything gets placed. And yet, they live in a world where they have all these structures, all these social structures, government structures, NGOs, various types of large corporations that have global international reaches in their various markets. Where do you, something that's really much more important on the macroscopic level, people have no idea where to put things. They have no idea. In that case, where does the refrigerator go? I don't know. I don't know. Well, where does the dining room table go? Well, I don't know. And my point is, it's important to understand this because these structures are the major anthropogenic inputs to this policy and extinction events that we have currently going on. I live right next to the Amazon jungle. I'm there all the time. They frequent topic among the indigenous. We're killing the planet, and we're doing so at a very rapid pace. And this transcends any kind of fragmented microanalysis of, oh, well, CO2 is too high, or we've got to really talk about methane hydrates, or we've got to talk about Fukushima. It's the cumulative effect of everything we're doing. It's not any one factor. We are creating a lifeless planet, and the biggest anthropogenic inputs of that come from what? Government. Now, let's say for a moment, let's do a little thought experiment. Let's say, Vincent, you and I are extraterrestrials. We have found this really interesting galaxy called the Milky Way, and there's a planet way, way, way out on the outer edges of Sagittarius, and we've decided that we want to take over. We want to kill every single carbon-based life form on. We want to make it sterile. We're going to clean out the petri dish, and we're not going to kill some things. We're going to kill everything. That's our goal, because we're just malevolent evil ETs. That's just what we are. So you and I got this conspiracy going on. What would be the first thing you and I would have to do in the execution of our conspiracy? And I maintain that the first thing we would do, if this was our objective, is find a way to control the apex predator, the one species that has more control of things on the planet than anything else. Currently, that just happens to be Homo sapiens. Some people might say Homo industrialis, but let's say Homo sapiens, and create something that you and I now call government, something that allows us to control structures that maximize entropy. And I get into the whole thermodynamics of that in the book. And I understand that's a complex subject for some people, but if you're really going to get into the nitty-gritty of this, you have to approach it as the intellectual subject that it really is. And we'd have to do that. I wrote this book because right now we are living on the precipice. In fact, the follow-up book to this is that's the title of it, Living on the Precipice. We are living in a time where things are going to go in one of two directions. We're either going to, everything's going to get killed off, which is kind of a takeoff of an interview you did that I really liked a lot. You did an interview in November of 2013. Hard to believe it's 4.5 years now, but you did an interview with Guy McPherson. I love that interview. People should look at it because the things that Professor McPherson talks about in that interview you did are actually truer today than they were 4 years ago. And we're to go in the direction of complete decrescence and the completion of a mission to make this planet sterile, or we make it into something healthy. Guy McPherson is thrown in the towel. I don't know if you know this or not. He did a YouTube called Fuck It. That was the name of the YouTube, Fuck It. He took Elizabeth Beth Kubler-Ross's, you know, six stages of grief. Do you remember that? Shock, whatever, you know, shock, regret, error.
It's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
Acceptance. There you go. Thank you very much. That's the sixth stage. And so he says, I'm going to create a seventh step. I'm throwing in the towel. Fuck it. So maybe it's the part of me that's optimistic, can't grapple with that. Believes that there is.
Can I offer an observation on that? Because I went through that process as well, then became a talk radio show host, and then I found out that that process doesn't just stop at acceptance. It goes back around again. You start denying different stuff and getting angry at different stuff and bargaining with different people and getting depressed about different things and then accepting them again before you start denying them again and getting angry and that kind of thing. And that's the problem. When you accept your purpose in life, you know, you think, yo, I got a purpose or whatever, you don't realize that you're still carrying behind you, like in a little red wagon, this enormous garbage pile of crap that you've emotionally accumulated throughout the vast course of dealing with people who are complete idiots, who don't support you, who are not encouraging you, who are telling you to give up. And also, not only it's people that are doing it, it's the things that you're studying, the things that we see make our minds fucked. Okay, let's not just mince words here. The things we see and the things we do, if we're looking at something important and doing something important with our lives, it'll mess with our heads. Okay, there's no other way around it. You can't come to important realizations without trauma, essentially. And that grief process marks the beginning of the trauma process again, and you go round the circle. So it's that kind of thing. The old adage of enlightenment is, what do you do before enlightenment? You chop wood and you carry water. What do you do after enlightenment? You chop wood and you carry water. The process of your life doesn't change at all just because you understand how life works.
Well, yeah, well, then I, if you say it that way, I've been through countless repetitions of that. But if we are to summate the whole thing and to pan out so that we have the largest picture of all, we have the picture that takes into account the maximum number of elements that are contributing to where we are in this planet, it is that I have to believe, and this is the point I've come to at the end of a very long journey, that either we find a way to co-create a healthy world, not even knowing how in the hell we are going to dig ourselves out of this. We either do that, we throw in the towel. And maybe this is a character flaw on my part. I'm just not the kind of guy to throw in the towel. I actually have gone into the Amazon. I have taken every major tool, allow me to use the vernacular here, to trip off my ass that you can imagine. I have been on countless journeys with Brungamuncia, with ayahuasca, Malakawa, San Pedro cactus, because these things are not, these things are used for the acquisition of knowledge about things from the other side. Acquisition of knowledge is about ourselves, our planet, our future, the multiple timelines that exist, not in a universe, but in a multiverse, the various timelines that exist and how they interact with each other. It's pretty heavy. It's not the kind of thing you can learn in any university. You could spend 50 years studying the university and you won't accumulate the knowledge of the things that I've accumulated in some instances in a matter of minutes. We have a very, very limited, truncated idea of what knowledge is in the West. And it's knowledge is accumulated in a very linear fashion. But there are ways of accumulating knowledge where you get rushes of information in the matter of a few hours that would take you many years in a university. And this is what I set myself on the path of doing, to try to come to grips with the horrific facts that were before me. And I've come to the conclusion that there is a purposeful, there's a purposefulness in all of this. And where it leads is our appreciation of the fact that you can't really understand, and I'm going to speak in very general terms, you can't really understand the light unless you've seen the dark. You can't appreciate light until you've seen kinds of shadows that are that are produced between the interplay of light and dark. But I can't think of another subject that we could possibly talk about that is more serious than this one. The speed, the speed at which we are headed toward a lifeless world, headed toward a situation where our planet is no more life-supporting than Pluto. It's shocking to me. And because I'm an herbalist and because I deal with all ecosystems, because Ecuador is it's an amazing place. I mean, we have the coast and all the ecosystems there. We have the Andes Mountains where I live. I live here at 10,000 feet in the Andes. We have the Amazon jungle. And we have all of these microbiomes that exist in between. And I am seeing a movement in the direction of the lifeless in all of it. We have done nothing to stop this very rapid deterioration of the ozone layer. And we now have information that if this continues, if we continue to go from UVA to B to C to microwave, we will produce a situation where you're not even capable of growing plants outdoors. This is what we have done. And the cause of it, there's not natural causes. It is, I will say, at least 90% anthropogenic. And for someone that has, as I do as an herbalist, a relationship with plants that borders on the romantic, it's very painful to watch. It's very painful to watch what we're doing to this planet. So, of course, taking into account all the things that I experienced in my hand-to-hand combat with the wackos in Washington, D.C., all of these causal connections became even more important to me, because I think there's nothing else we can talk about right now that's more important. And I don't know how much time we have. You know, you talk to Guy McPherson, it's 10 years. You talk to others, 15, 20. Go back to that famous article that Bill Joy, co-founder of Sun Microsystems, wrote in 2002, Why the Future Does Not Need Us. He said it's easily within the century. You have people in very high places who basically, if you speak to them in private, will tell you, yeah, you know, mankind, we're probably not going to have any planet, any human beings living on this planet in another 20, 30 years. They just say this matter-of-factly, like you would tell me what you had for breakfast this morning. Just very matter-of-factly. Yeah, we're going to kill everything off, yeah, but there's really nothing we can do about it. What is wrong with people? They could, you know, talk this way and not make the discussion of these developments It's more important than anything else. Instead of we're going to talk about what, politicians and their sex lives, or, you know, someone betting a porn star, that's really important. That's really important stuff to talk about. I don't know. I think we've got a value system that's turned upside down. So that's the crux of it, really. I mean, and I realize, you know, it takes me the better part of 350 pages to lay out my case. But that's the abbreviated version of it. That's the truncated version of it right there.
Mm. Now, it's been very painful just to listen to you explain that, because you're cutting out just a slight bit here and there and everywhere, that kind of thing. We tried to get those issues sorted before the show today. Unfortunately, they're not working as best as we could hope, but I'll just suffer through it and grit my teeth and cringe as you get cut out constantly. It's just... Basically, we can hear what you're saying as you go through. It's just that there's these little gaps in between what you're saying, which makes it, as a live broadcast, extraordinarily painful for me to listen to. Because I look back and I go, the editing job on this one. Let's cut out a microsecond there and there and there and there and there and there about 5,000 times. This is going to be fun. Oh, dear God. Oh, no, it's terrible. So if there is any way to, close web browsers or anything else that's sucking the internet around there, that would be really helpful right about this point in time. But other than that, like I say, we'll just struggle through it. Now, the concept with Guy McPherson, and that was quite interesting, because I'm not like a climate changer thing, but what's been spoken about recently is – or at least come to my mind recently, is analysis versus meta-analysis, all right? One analysis goes, oh, CO2 is a driver in climate change, therefore it's the entire causation and the only thing we've got to worry about. No, 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 let's not worry about pesticides, herbicides, GMOs and artificial additives in the food and things like that. No, 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 that's not environmental issues anymore, radiation in the water. No, 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 it's just carbon dioxide, mate, just carbon dioxide, the only thing we've got to worry about. And you take a meta-analysis view and you go, well, there's about 5,000 different things that are simultaneously killing the planet, and they all kind of have a root cause, people who make decisions that don't take any responsibility for their decisions. All right, and essentially that's what it is. And I believe that that's part of the reason for the resurgence and the I wouldn't say resurgence, but the explosion of popularity of commentators like Jordan Peterson, is their willingness to say, let's just take personal responsibility for ourselves. Let's stand up to evil. Let's stand up and fight back, and let's love our children and let's be healthy, that kind of thing. And then we'll be able to actually do something about what it is we are trying to accomplish, which is live long, happy, and fruitful life. Essentially, everybody wants that exact same thing. The difference becoming, of course, that there are people who don't want that for everybody else, who, as you say, think of life as a zero-sum game, that there is a winner and there is a loser. There is no game that they can play where everyone can win. And this mentality...
Well, that's...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
That's part of... trying to do something here to improve.
It's got significantly worse.
The audio flow.
I'm just going to keep mumbling.
Is there a way that? Oh my god.
Yeah. Live radio, folks. You can't make this stuff up, and there is nothing you could do to stop it from happening. Okay, so we're just going to try and be professional. And I'm just going to ramble a little bit about these concepts as they're coming to me, because it's quite an important topic, the psychopathocracy, because when I see a lot of the measures people take, whether it be on a grand scale or even on a small scale, to achieve some kind of ends of justice etc., or to create a better world, often they will do things like voting for the right person or the right party and that kind of thing, unknowing that this is actually part of the psychopathocracy. Or they will join certain environmental groups, not knowing that this is part of the psychopathocracy. Or they'll go to get educated at a university, not knowing that this is part of the psychopathocracy. And this is the other thing that I've started to become aware of a lot more recently, is that there are a million different ways that the system can try and control you, but there's lots of different ways that don't yet exist that you can resist the control structure. But the problem is we've got to create those things ourselves, because ultimately when it comes to the creation of a solution or the shall we say the explaining of a problem, essentially what it takes is dedication. And dedication is something that is very, very sorely missing in this society, because it's supposed to be something you grow up with. No, son, you've got to do this, that, and the other. You know, you've got to clean your room and such and blah, blah, blah. But we don't do that. And school doesn't tell us to do this. University doesn't tell us to do this. Ergo, we've got an entire generation's worth of people who can't actually effectively resist psychopaths. And they sit around and they wonder why psychopaths are still in charge. It's because you're the only ones who can resist them, and you're not, right?
Well, is my audio any better now or not?
It's still about the same. Like I say, it's like just cutting out here and there, but all the words that you're saying do come through.
Okay.
Now, we could switch to that other computer you were on before the show that had no webcam, that had really good clear audio. Maybe just try flicking off your webcam and we'll see if that works.
Okay, hold on one moment.
And this reminds me of a conversation that I had with, I think it was my brother-in-law around Christmas one year. And he said, hey, Vinny, what would be the way, you know, I don't want to learn anything and I don't want to listen or anything. But if you could tell me what the one thing that, you know, could be done to prevent the world becoming the way you reckon it's becoming. And I said to him, well, you've got to teach children, you know, whether through allegory or whatever, about psychopathy and narcissism and complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Only then will they actually kind of understand why bad people do the things that they do. It's because they're badly damaged. All right, so Greg, let's see if you're talking all right now.
I'm going to switch to okay. Having taken video off, is that any better now?
It's slightly better.
I am so sorry. I don't know why we're having this kind of well, when you're in South America, internet service is a bit dicey anyways. This is not first world internet quality.
It's just not. But as I say, don't feel like you have to just not say anything because the audio's crap or whatever. We can scrub that up after the show. It's a bit of a hassle, but you know, it'll work. So in the meantime, you've got to get to what was it that other computer that you got to beforehand, just before this one.
Oh, that that'll take really me.
Good, but it didn't have webcam.
Hold on.
Yeah, I apologize for the. You want what?
Just take one moment.
Okay, no worries. Just give us a yell out when you're ready, and you can hang up and then rejoin the call as it's running, I believe. And I'll just riff it on here for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. So, yes, I have got personal experience, and this is the reason why psychopathy is actually probably such a such an interest to me. It's because a lot of the times that subjects will draw people's interest is because of personal experience. So my personal experience with psychopathy was like mainly in the business world, and after getting busted by police, And also in the truth movement, you know, you have people who try to recruit you, try to do work for them, that kind of thing. They don't pay you. They just and then when you try to question them or anything like that, they abuse you and they attack you and that kind of thing. And you wonder what kind of level does that operate at? How many good people in the truth movement have been screwed over by psychopaths within the truth movement? And their trajectory in life that was only going up and up and up, you know, they were getting more popular, they were getting better and everything like that, got cut down massively, like because the psychopath shafted them, stole something from them, destroyed their lives. And as a result, you've got oodles of talented people throughout the truth movement who, by right, should be a lot more popular than they are, who literally have had their souls broken by evil psychopaths in the truth movement. Because they weren't aware going in that just because you're a part of a cause now for to do the right thing doesn't mean that's the only reason people are there. All right, Greg, let's see if you're back there.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Okay, so, sir, I don't really know why the other system wasn't working, but at least we've got good audio. Okay, well, this is the thing. I think this is the greatest analogy I can think of, and I'll pull it right now. Hold on one second.
So much better that audio, eh, folks?
How I open
I'm
things
glad, I'm glad I mentioned something.
Yeah.
I was sitting there going,
Okay. Well, I open the book with a very big picture of a spoon, because everybody knows what a spoon is. And this is how I open things, because it's important to make this have this understanding. There's a large picture of a spoon, and then the text says, this is a spoon. There are many things you can do with a spoon. You can use it to dig small holes. You can bang it against other spoons or objects to create what you think is music. You can use a spoon to fill up your radiator out of your car with water when you can't find a water hose or a pitcher, a carton, a funnel, or a small glass. You can use your spoon to annoy your cat. There are 1,000 things you can find to do with a spoon, yet there's only one function for which it's best suited and for which people use it 99% of the time, to eat food or take medicine. In other words, you use it to ingest things through your mouth, particularly small quantities of liquid or soft food. The reason that this is a spoon's best function is because that is the purpose for which it was created. Any other function is artificial and not in keeping with the spoon's original design or its essential nature. So then I have a picture of a large government building. Actually, it's the Capitol building in Washington. This is government. There are many things you can do with government. You can use it to rally people to a cause. You can use it to tell people how much you care about social justice, civil rights, law and order, the environment, world peace, racism, or democracy. There are 1,000 uses you can find for government. Yet there's only one function for which it is best suited and for which its designers use it 99% of the time, to mask, nurture, cultivate, and actuate criminal conspiracies. In other words, you use government to create the appearance of goodness when in fact it acts as a cover for the most evil and hideous human activities imaginable. The reason that this is a government's best function is because that is the purpose for which it was created. Any other function is artificial and not in keeping with government's original design or its essential nature. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important because when you have these structures in place, and we've only got like, what, over 200 nation states, when you have these structures in place, which the very purpose for which they were created was to hide criminal conspiracies, that those structures have their effect on the environment. It goes beyond how they treat the poor governed, the people that have to put up with these people, the people who are the governed. It has to deal with what their relationship is to other systems, other ecosystems. And my point is that if you're living on a planet that's dying, do you think you'd want to know what the cause was of why you were living on a dying planet? I think it's important to know that. At least if you're going to go down with the ship, would you want to know why your ship sank? I don't know. Maybe some people don't want to know.
Well, a lot of people don't want to know that the sinking of the Titanic was an insurance scam by J.P. Morgan, and to get rid of a lot of his industrial competition who he invited on the vessel.
Yeah, well, that's been pretty well established. But the other thing that really kind of eats me is, you know, people's lack of appreciation for the fact that false flags and other forms of distraction are very, very important to the government. It's a very, very important part of their playbook. And at least as it relates to, you know, obviously having been born in the United States, I know U.S. history better than I do in any other country. But I mean, going all the way back to the Boston Tea Party in December of 1773, you know, that was a false flag. The United States has gone from one false flag to another. And all these recent shootings that you have in the United States, because they really want to make sure that everybody's disarmed so they have even more control over people, you know, that people just can't look at the facts and see it for what it is, that they're going to, you know, in my book, I compare listening to the media, to the mass, to the mainstream media, to going to a wrestling match. Now, I don't know if these things exist in New Zealand, but we have these events in the United States. It's professional wrestling. I don't know why they call it professional wrestling, because there's nothing professional about it. But you get these two bulky looking guys that go into the ring, beat each other over the head with chairs and everything else, and they play their little game, and at the end of it, somebody's won. And you get arenas full of thousands of people to watch these events, rooting for their favorite star. And what they're doing is they're having to pretend that what they're seeing is real. It's not real. The guys in the ring, they're not athletes. They're actors. The whole thing's pre-scripted. When both guys go in the ring, they already know who's going to win and who's going to lose. There's nothing professional about it. It's not an athletic event. It's an entertainment event. But the problem I have is that's how people deal with the rest of their world. They watch, for instance, an election, not realizing that behind the scenes, the person who's going to win, it's already been decided. Elections have no real meaningful purpose anymore, because the people that pull the strings, they control both sides. And worse than that, the person who's going to win has already been chosen. You know, that's why they had to take out the guys who authored the book Vote Scam in the United States. You know, you can't have people walking around on the street who talk that much truth in one single book. I mean, it's gotten to be that ridiculous. And what's disturbing me even more in terms of recent events, you know, when Alec Tocqueville, the Frenchman, wrote Democracy in America in 1832, I remember one of the things he talked about is he said, I can't believe how restricted thought is in the United States, how people's thinking is channeled in just one direction. I can't believe it. He said, even during the Spanish Inquisition, there was more freedom of thought during the Spanish Inquisition than you have in America today. Well, when he says today, he's talking early 1830s. You fast forward now to a period of time that's roughly 180 years later. It's far more restrictive today than it was in America 180 years ago. And that's what disturbs me. It's this, and this is what makes me think that the people that are in charge are getting nervous, because in the past, they didn't care what people like you or I said. They wouldn't have needed structures like Facebook and Google to go on there and kick people off because they didn't say things that were politically correct that the elite don't like. You didn't see any of that nonsense going on. You do now. You do now, and it's getting more and more restricted. It's getting to a point where anyone who speaks any kind of modicum of truth about what's going on in the world is labeled a quack or a nutcase and marginalized as being insane. And that's a very dangerous development, and it's quite historical.
Well, I find it even affects those people who try to tell those truths as well. Like, I had a lady who was going to come on my show, and then she had a look at like some of the other topics and things like that that are going on my show, and then she just freaked out and went with her gut and says, no, I don't want to come on the show. And it's like, okay, so you're allegedly a fellow truth teller who doesn't want to come on a show to tell the truth because your gut tells you not to. That's fear governing.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I get these people all the time that say, you know, if you talk about these things, aren't you worried? I'm sure that you hear the same things. Aren't you worried that if you talk about these things, they're just not going to take you out? And my response to that is you better start opening your eyes and paying attention. We're all being assassinated right now between the chemtrails and the GMO foods and all that. in the Fukushima's, and behind that is another 200 Fukushima's, because all we need is one good Carrington event and it's lights out. I mean, this whole idea, well, I'm not going to talk about something because I'm afraid that somebody in power is going to be upset about it and take me out. We're in the process of being taken out. You know, pick your poison, slow or fast, because if we don't do something about this, if we don't at least have the ability to speak about these things openly and discuss how we can attempt to at least psychically, if not in the physical realm, try to co-create something better, then, you know, what's the point? What's the point of any of this? You know, they can have it.
Mm.
They can have the sterilized world, because the people that are doing this, that's how criminally insane they are. They don't realize that what they're doing is creating a world where they're not going to have grandchildren or great-grandchildren. There is no lineage after this. This is the end of it. We don't appreciate the fact that life is a very fragile thing. Speaking now as a botanist and an herbalist and a gardener and a farmer, because I own a farm here and I sell my produce, people don't realize how precious a gift life is. And when you take it for granted and you mistreat it, and when you expose it to the maximum systems of exploitation we're doing this planet, you get to the point where you are headed toward complete, total, planetary collapse of your life systems. And to me, that's I can't think of anything that's a more important topic to discuss.
Well, to me, my response to the most serious things is usually to laugh about them, and that way you rob them of the fear aspect, because what fear does is it activates your reptilian cortex of your brain and sucks energy away from your primate brain, which does a lot of your thinking. So a lot of people will be not thinking when they're supposed to be thinking, more or less. So we have two completely different responses. Some guy comes up to you and asks that question. Another guy come up to me and ask a question. He goes, Vinny, you know, with what you're doing, do you think, like, you're putting your life in danger? And I was like, well, one can only hope. Because that... We cracked up laughing so much that we really irritated the live band and the people who were trying to listen to them behind us.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
okay, and then in so doing, you rob the power of that situation to rob you of your sanity, more or less. Because a lot of the things that happen to us, if we don't keep a sense of humor about it, we lose ourselves in the process. And ultimately, we need ourselves, because
yeah, you
we
have,
the things
have
that are going
to
resist these people.
If you're going to, if you know, I guess I am the quintessential American. You know, the give me liberty or give me death. You know, kind of a guy. I don't want to live in the world that they've envisioned, because it is so dark and so evil and so. There's nothing attractive to me about living in the world that the psychopaths in charge actually envision. And I don't believe, when you really understand the thermodynamics of this situation, I don't believe we're going to get there. We're not going to have one world order, because it is so, it maximizes entropy. It sucks all the remaining life of whatever life systems you have. It's a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. Now I know they don't believe that. I know they think they've won, and they're going to continue working in the direction of this grand dystopian vision they have that gives them what dreams at night, but they're never going to get there. And I actually get into the physics of that as well. A healthy planet involves innumerable reciprocal relationships at all levels, from horizon B all the way up to your topsoil, all the way up to the creatures that fly in the air. I mean, it's all about these intricate, these networks of reciprocal behavior. None of that exists in their world, because in their world, you take and you take and you take, and you never have to give back. You don't have to do that, because you're the one in charge. You can just selfishly take whatever you want and not worry about the consequences of your behavior. And anyone who thinks that you can actually manage a planet that way and expect it to have any longevity to it in terms of the life forms that are on it, it's just doesn't understand biology. They just don't.
Or at the very least, they simply don't have any respect for it and kind of want to wipe it out and see it as a cancer on this planet. Oh, it's things that are growing and freely and not hurting anything else. That must be cancerous. Let's cut it out. Well, I think one thing somebody said to me was that no matter how insane you think the people in charge are, they're way more insane than you could possibly imagine. Right. And this gave me a thought that most of the things that the government and these evil things that don't seem to make sense to people like us with a conscience actually make perfect sense if you don't have a conscience. You know, give the devil his due. They know what they're doing and they're doing it and they're benefiting from it. They just really don't have a very smart idea in terms of long-term sustainability while they constantly talk about sustainability. I mean, the irony is not lost on me.
No, I think it's a grand experiment. You know, there was one individual, it's the best way I know to express it. They had a QHHT session, a quantum healing, a hypnotic technique. And he said, what you are going through was an experiment to see how far from the light life could exist, and not expunge itself. Well, we've reached that far end point. We've reached that far end point. We know now what happens when any real goodness, any real any respect for these reciprocal relationships I'm talking about at the foundation of all good ecosystems is completely wiped out. Well, we know what you get. And I have to believe that there is an intelligence in the universe because at least as I see it as a biologist, you can't escape the purpose and the needfulness for these systems. And once you step outside that boundary where everything is negaprosity, then you just see total ecosystem collapse. And that's what we're seeing around the world right now. I still can't believe here it is 7 years after Fukushima. I still can't believe the reports that we get just get worse and worse and worse. And that's just one example of what they've unleashed on us. Because I don't know if how familiar you are with Lynn Murray's work, but there's certainly a lot of solid evidence that both Chernobyl in 1986 and Fukushima in 2011 were quite deliberately set off. They weren't accidents. They were deliberate. And the evidence for that is pretty clear when you get into the nitty-gritty of Lynn Murray's observations and the people she's been in touch with. So – you know, as a friend of mine in Australia likes to say, until we get beyond this Babylonian death cult that has gripped the people that are in charge of the planet, it's not going to get any better. We will only go worse. It'll only get worse.
Now, if it's a cult, cults control their membership in a number of different ways. Malnutrition, sleep deprivation, group herd mentality with a central authority figure, mindless repetition, and ostracization of outside ideas. Now, if you were to think about what are the fundamental rules that people in this modern society have to live under, it's those, isn't it?
Well, there's another component of it. I mean, I think we're forgetting the fact that when you have people in charge who are psychopathic, they're is a certain psychic discharge. There's a certain pleasure, a certain thrill they get from knowing that they have the power to maim, kill, poison, destroy. I mean, that has its own pleasures. That's how I got the title of my book, The Joys of Psychopathocracy. They're enjoying what they're doing. It's not just an issue of, well, we're having to keep people in this, in our cult and prevent them from leaving. They don't want to leave. You want to leave. If you live off of that and you get a certain thrill off knowing that if you can maximize the pain and agony of the people that have to live on this planet, that's a big thrill for you, that excites you, why would you want to leave? We have to face the fundamental reality, and I spend a good amount of this book going through the particulars in terms of what we know clinically about what we know about psychopathy. We have to face the reality that this is what feeds these people. That's what gives them a thrill. That's what they get off on. That's why you've got all this pedophilia and all this other stuff that you'd hear about at the very, very highest levels of the pyramid. All these satanic rituals and killing little children and sucking their blood. And I mean, who the hell does that unless someone is really sick in the head? But those again are the people in charge. We're on a plane altogether. There's 8 billion of us on a plane, and you've got a handful of people in the cockpit who are kamikaze pilots. And the thrill is so great for them. You know what this is like? This is like a Coney Cana. Look at every heroin addict knows if they keep at it, they're going to end up killing themselves. If they keep upping the dose and upping the frequency that they're taking their drug of choice, they know how the end goes. But they can't do anything about it because the thrill is just more important than considering the consequences of action. And that's where we are on this planet. The people in charge, the thrill of knowing you have the power to destroy everything in sight is such a thrill. It is such an orgasmic thrill. They can't help themselves.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Psychopathy. It destroys your brain so that all the things that normally keep you healthy and stable and things like that, actually you need to become an adrenaline junkie, a murder junkie or something like that, because only then will you get a nice dopamine release to make you feel like you're not an empty vessel of nothingness. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our stringent quality controls and absolute zero GMOs plus testing for heavy metals makes us unique in the storable foods market. Our line of fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Take out the amount you need and reseal the package for use within the next 6 months. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's www.simplycleanfoods.net today.
American Survival Wholesale is a proud sponsor of the American Freedom Radio. And when you purchase quality products from AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com, you help support this program. Our quality non-GMO foods do not contain MSG, high fructose corn syrup, or heavy metals. At American Survival Wholesale, you can choose from over 8,000 quality products, including self-defense weapons, bug-out bags, and long-term storable food at wholesale prices. We also have custom food packs available, including gluten-free, dairy-free, and vegetarian packs. If we don't have it, you don't need it. American Survival Wholesale is a veteran-owned and operated company, which also supports our veterans in need, and we are very active in disaster relief. If you would like to become a distributor, please email us at bugoutamerica@usa.com or call 818-720-0759. We offer free consultations to answer all your questions. Do it today while things are calm. That's AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com.
Nicotine, alcohol, good drugs. Coincidentally, tax drugs. Ooh, how does this work? Thank God they're taxing alcohol, man. It means we got those good roads we can drive on. Because I'll tell you something, I'll be honest, man. If I were going to legalize a drug, it sure wouldn't have been alcohol. Sorry, there's better drugs and better drugs for you. That's a fact. Pot is a better drug than alcohol. Fact. Fact. Stop your internal dialogue. But Bill, alcohol's on... Shut up! You're wrong. Get over it. I'll prove it to you, man. You're at a ball game or a concert and someone's really violent and aggressive and obnoxious. Are they drunk or are they smoking pot? They're drunk. I have never seen people on pot get in a fight because it is impossible. Hey, buddy. Hey, what? Hey. End of argument.
What has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously a factor, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does.
Well, they never censor, hang up, or cut off their guests. Well, that's no fun, is it?
Oh, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shills and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative mainstream and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
Launch sequence initiated.
We're now in the approach phase. Everything looking good.
Delete the turbo the all out.
Prepare your mind to experience American Freedom Radio.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Is good. It relieves the tension and the fear of death.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Must apologize for the audio quality in the first hour, but we managed to fix it, so it's all good. In fact, a thought occurred to me while I was coming back from a very, very short break that, we should probably do that first hour again. But, no, what you do is you keep moving forward, getting into the deeper details and things of that nature, specifically the workings. Why is it? Because people understand this dynamic, or at least some people do, that psychopaths usually end up in control. Why is that? Like, what gives them the advantage over people who do have a conscience in the workplace, in government?
It's structural. It's actually that just the analogy I gave earlier was about a spoon. You know, you can't change what a spoon is. It does what it was designed to use. People use it to eat things. There's a thousand other things you can do with a spoon, but there's only one thing that people use a spoon for 99% of the time. And it just happens to correspond for the very reason for why it was created in the first place. Okay, apply that same incredibly simple to understand concept to government. Think of government the way you would a spoon. Structurally, what a government is it creates what American anthropologist Sullins referred to as sectoral distance. Let's say you have a representative, an assemblyman, or whatever, in all of these countries in the world that claim to be democratic. Do they even know 0.1% of the people they say they represent? If I hired you to represent me in something, say you're a lawyer or you're whatever it is that you're doing, in some form or fashion, you're going to act in a kind of agency. You're representing my interest. Would it be helpful at all for you to know who I am, what I want, what my needs are? How can I possibly hire you to do something if you don't know who I am, what I want you to do? But yet we've got all these, we've got all over the world, we've got those people who say, well, I represent the people in my district. I represent the people in the city of Timbuktu. You do not. It's not structurally possible. You have to understand strict strokes. I'm convinced unless people can understand this concept of sectoral distance, which I get into great lengths in my book, they can't understand why It is impossible to have good government. It's an oxymoron. Good government is not possible. Now, I hear people say all the time, well, how could you say that? I get my Social Security check. I get free medical if I'm in Canada. I get socialized medicine. I get this. I get that. Those are little bones that are thrown your way. Okay? Let's say for an example, next example I give in the book, I am a murderer. Every Halloween, it's just a thing with me. I go out and I rape and murder three women. I do it every Halloween. I just can't help myself. I just love to go out and murder people. Okay. I love to go out and rape and murder women, but I only do it one day a year. Now, would you buy the argument that you shouldn't call me a bad person because look it, the rest of the year, I pay my taxes, I go to church, I get to work on time, I obey the traffic laws. You shouldn't think of there's 365 days of the year. Shit, I only kill people one day a year, so how could I be a bad person? Because I'm 365 a great guy. Okay, this is the argument that people who support government have. The fact of the matter is just in the last 100 years alone, we've only murdered like 300 million people in all these various wars, World War I, World War II, you know, one war after another. And every government in the world, because, you know, they all end up taking sides. Well, we're with the Allied powers. No, we're with the Axis powers. They all take sides. So there is blood on the hands of every government on this earth in varying degrees. And just like the analogy I just gave you, you'd have to be insane to say that I am basically a good person because I only go out and rape, murder people one day a year. This is the same principle of government. It's what is its essential nature? What was it designed to do? Government was designed to promote criminal activity. And if we study it with the degree of precision that I do so in my book, we know that with the same degree that we know that a spoon's best function is for a human to use it to eat something. And in fact, that's what people actually use spoons to do. Same thing.
The very structure of it. Okay, because there's another element here. What was it called? Political ponerology, the study of evil as it relates to politics.
I quote it in my book. Yeah, it's done by a group of Polish intellectuals. Well done, but it's still, and by the way, it's a well-written book. I mean, these guys actually lives were sacrificed to get that book out. I think there's a certain simplicity to the way I present it so that people can actually, we can get beyond this idea of it's an opinion that anarcho-primitivism is a theory. It's a philosophy. I want to get it beyond that. I want to turn it into a science with the same degree of precisions that we know something in chemistry that if you add a strong acid and a strong base, you get an exothermic reaction. With that same degree of certitude, I want people to understand it is never possible, nor has it ever been, it is not now, nor will it ever be the case that you can ever have good government. It simply is not possible. It's a structural thing. And you have to really get deeply into an understanding of structure, of relationships, of sectoral distance, of these various concepts that Solon talked about to really understand. Good government is never possible. You can create the appearance of good government for a time. Just like I only kill women and rape and murder one day a year and the other day I'm great. Okay, I can create for a time the appearance that I'm just this great guy. But you're never going to get beyond the idea that if I were to do the things I just said to you, I'm a horrible human being. I'm a murderer. Don't try to make it sound better than it is. I'm a murderer. I go out and murder people one day a year. And, you know, government, that's a lot because I think the one day a year, you know, in the case of the United States, it's not one day a year. It's 11 months out of 12. All these and bomb dropping and everything else. It's not one day a year. Well, we only go out and murder people 11 months out of 12. We're good 1 month. We don't go out and kill people 1 month out of the year.
Well, I'd say they just kill people 364 days a year. And then on a leap year, they take a break, you know.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. So I think it's important to understand structurally what healthy human life is about. And what healthy human life is about close human interaction so that there is the bonds of love and affection that emanate from the very core of what human life is about. And what is that? Well, it's the family. We know it is the family. a man and a woman and his kids and their joint efforts to bring joy and happiness into those children as they grow up. That basic human instinct that it's the very core of human life. If that same energy doesn't permeate all the other structures that exist in your society, then you live in a sick society. And that's what we live in, a sick society. We don't have any of those forms of energy from which human life emanates and the broader social structures that guide our societies.
I was just thinking about this. Are there any broad structures that actually do work with a core of love that don't become corrupted and infiltrated?
There's not. And it's the reason is because it's about structure. It's about understanding what Solomon's called sectoral distance. He has all these sectors, and he says the farther you get away from that core, the farther you get away, the more distance you create between people, where you get the people in charge are lording over individuals they don't even know who they are. Then you become something that is materialized into nothingness, into something that is inordinate. You have in whatever country you're in, you have no more value to the people in charge than a rock. You're not a sentient being. You don't deserve compassion. You don't deserve love. You don't deserve anything because you're just an inanimate object. Sectoral distance feeds that energy. It feeds this disconnect in human life that gives rise to psychopathic structures. The structures themselves create and promulgate and nurture these energies which are divorced from that core human energy from which healthy life emanates.
And that would be about the size of a family. I was just thinking as well, what's the limit then? Because if any major organization of any kind, essentially, will eventually get taken over by psychopaths and become psychopathic, regardless of how positive its intentions, what's the largest family you can have before it cannot be done with the basis of love anymore?
Well, you can have – there are structures that exist for which you have a very close sectoral distance. You know, when, you know, this whole idea that Christopher Columbus discovered America, you know, when Christopher Columbus came to the first hit the Bahama Islands, the American hemisphere had an estimated 150 million indigenous peoples living in it. That's the estimate. How can you say you discovered a land where you've already got 150 million people living there? And in those tribes in the United States, we had roughly, they say, around 500 to 600 nations. Even though there were extended periods, there was expanse geographically in the Cherokee Nation, in the Lakota, among the Lakotas, among the Navajo, Blackfoot. I mean, if you actually look at especially the Plains Indians, where they were very nomadic, they didn't stay in one place. They were nomadic. Still, you had this interconnections and appreciation for life. And they thought of themselves as a tribe. They thought of themselves as family. There were still these ideas that brought about interconnections from the tribe, and it wasn't considered healthy to consider parts of the tribe separate from the group. And all of that was lost. A lot of this is in a book published in 1932 called The Gospel of the Red Man, written by Setton, S-E-T-O-N. Very good book, by the way. But it actually sets the basis of what were the beliefs of the people that we took over. And the conclusion of several people that studied it was, we have wiped out nations of people who were far morally superior to ourselves. We have wiped out entire nations of people who are morally superior to ourselves. Well, what made them morally superior? I would proffer that what made them morally superior was an appreciation of the fact that once the sense of family is extricated from your society and people become distant and inanimate objects, you have set yourself on the path to psychopathocracy. It becomes a structural thing, and it's not correctable. There's no time in history where I could find any examples. And by the way, I'm quite a historian. I've read, everything was from the works of Oswald Spengler, the complete works of Arnold, the great British historian, Arnold Toynbee's series on history, the work of William and Ariel Durant in the history of civilization. I can find no examples where this doesn't happen, where if you maximize sectoral distance, you don't get psychopathocracy.
How could we replicate that in our society from the ground up?
Well, I think in a way it's going to end up having, I think because it's the return to a kind of equilibrium, I think it's going to happen whether we like it or not, because as any evolutionary biologist will tell you, that overshoot and die-off usually occurs when a species reaches its maximum, it reaches a maximum population just before it crashes because of overshoot, because of its excessive use of its natural resources. Well, where are we right now? We're, you know, close to 8 billion people. And, you know, I mean, this is my personal view. I mean, you can get people on your show who disagree with me. I really believe that for a healthy planet, our footprint should probably be 500 million to maybe a billion people, but not 8 billion. I mean, we have so far gone into overshoot, and we know what happens when species go into overshoot. It's been very, very well documented. It's a standard feature of understanding biological biology just biology in general. That we know, I was in Louisiana. We know what happens when the deer population gets too high. They eat all the food and the deer starve. And at the end of it all, they end up with a population much smaller than when they started. So we know there's a relationship between a species and the resources that it uses to survive. And this has been going on for a long time now. You know, if you read The Fall by Steve Taylor, he talks about how the Sahara used to be the most verdant jungle in the whole world. Well, you just say the word Sahara, people think of a desert. Well, it is a desert. From Morocco all the way to eastern Egypt, you've got this huge desert area. But that used to all be like the Amazon. Well, what happened? Well, we know what happened. But 7,000 years ago, people went in there and they started eating and using everything in sight. And over a period of time, it just you saw its desertification. I think even on your show, you had Guy McPherson talking about, you know, you had all these people trying to leave to Africa and the Middle East and go to Europe. Why are they doing that? Well, because they have. We're seeing habitat collapse all over the world, so you're going to see more and more and more mass migrations of humans from areas that will no longer support life to areas that will. This is what happens when you're getting closer and closer to planetary death. Now, in 1985, I wrote a book called The Lumen Food for New Age, and even in that book, I talked about these things that we knew in the Gulf of Mexico, even back then, called dead zones. Let me tell you what dead zones are. You got these areas of bodies of water 50 miles wide, 150 miles deep, and they're mostly in the Gulf of Mexico because you get all this ag chemical runoff that goes down the Mississippi and dumps into the Gulf. And these 50 by 100 mile areas, the dead zones, there's nothing alive in there. Maybe some really hardy bacteria in there, but there's, in terms of fish or sea mammals or whatever, it's dead. Everything in there is dead. It's going to stay dead, and the dead zones are growing. And this is something that I observed in the mid-80s. And here we are, 30 years later, and what are we seeing? Well, we're seeing them in areas we've never seen them before. Used to, when we talked about dead zones, we talked about them in the Gulf. Well, not now. We got huge dead zones growing in the Pacific because of this whole Fukushima nonsense. And the way that we've got 5 trillion pieces of plastic garbage in the ocean. We got 50 times more plastic garbage in the ocean than we do phytoplankton, the largest mass of life on Earth. I mean, literally.
Just to back you up on that one, Greg saw a video yesterday that says that the total mass of rubbish plastic in the oceans will match that of all ocean life within the next few years. Right? The ocean will be equal parts plastic and ocean life.
So, you know, I was on an aircraft carrier back in the late 70s, and I was on a detail where we had to put all the garbage at the back of the fantail and push it off the back of the sheet. And believe me, trust me when I say, if you've got an aircraft carrier with 5,000 guys living on it, you produce a lot of garbage. And just a massive amount of plastic and everything. And we'd be back then. I remember on these runs in between Hawaii and Southern California, I'd look out over the ocean and just see all these plastic bags floating on the surface. It just, even then, you could see that we were just turning the oceans of the world, which take up 75% of the surface of the planet, into our own personal waste dumps as if that's a healthy thing to do. You know, it's so all this, I've seen this my whole life, you know, my whole life. I've seen where this is going, but only in the last few years has it become evident that, well, I've kind of, in this respect, I've reached the same place that McPherson has. I think we've reached a point of no return. That's why I say there has to be some kind of outside influence or outside element to write this course, because I don't see anything that is going to alter the inertia. There's inertial factors in place that say we can do nothing to stop the march toward a lifeless planet. We're not going to do anything. There's nothing we can do about the sterilizing of planet Earth. And that's why I have to believe there are certain factors in the universe that are more intelligent than we are that are going to come in and write this thing, because otherwise it's lights out. I mean, that's how serious it is. That's the direction we're headed in. And I've only been eyewitnessing it for 50 years now.
I've got this concept as well that even though there's nothing you can do, you can still do something. Is that true, or am I just fooling myself here?
I did a book in 2012 called The Gospel of 2012, According to Hiawatha. I wanted to do a series of really deep meditations, and I talk in the book about how there's certain abilities that I have when I'm Hiawatha that I don't have when I'm in my normal state of consciousness. And you can take this for what it's worth. Everyone has a right to disagree, but I was actually shown that this was a case where there would be outside influences. You could call them good ETs. You could call them celestial beings. I don't know what you want to call them. But I clearly saw that there would be this event, this kind of intervention into the affairs of this planet to prevent it from going from completely sterile. I go into a lot of other things in the book. It's like a 200-page book that I talk about this. But the gist of it is that, you know, I don't see the people that I'm going to speak very broadly now. You know, I'm not saying they sit up in bed and say, what can I do today to make Lucifer more happy? But one must wonder. And they don't win. They're not going to turn this into the lifeless, sterilized planet that would make the forces of evil just even happier than they are now. The Archons don't win at the end of the day. That, at least that's the gist of what I was showing. And I write it, like I say, it's something I wrote 6 years ago.
Have you reconsidered it since then?
No, I have. I mean, I've reconsidered in the sense, well, I don't want to say reconsidered. It sounds like a singular event. I think about it all the time. It's because I get these constant reminders. You know, I'm seeing the plants on my, you know, because I'm kind of the canary in the coal mine, in the sense that because I live at 10,000 feet, we get a lot more radiation here than you would, let us say, at sea level. And because of that, you know, I'm seeing signs of plants that are stressed because of the radiation. Here where we live, we get the local government gives us these radiation alerts. You know, don't be out in the sun. It's dangerous to be outside right now. Too much. I doubt that you get these, but we do here, because being at 10,000 feet, the radiation affects us a lot more than it does at lower levels. Remember, too, we've got 2/3 of the oxygen that you have at sea level. So it's an entirely different mode of living here. But speaking now as a grower, as a gardener, and as a farmer, I can tell you I'm seeing signs of plants being stressed by all of this excess radiation. It's something that you observe if you just have a close connection to your plants. And eventually, with time, the effect of this greater radiation from the sun, the effect of ozone layer depletion, we're going to be seeing more things along these lines. And I think we're going to reach a point where we're going to reach a critical mass where people are no longer able to avoid seeing what's happening. They're not going to be able to put their heads in the sand anymore. And most of the people that are observing this now are people who are close to nature or close to their plant life. I remember when they were doing, you had a director that did this two video series, you know, what in the world are they spraying? Why in the world are they spraying? Right. You're familiar with that? Remember the
Paul Wittenberger.
Okay, and you remember that they interviewed various gardeners and so forth in Hawaii, and they were able to just tear the bark off of a coconut tree. I mean, you'd never see that in a healthy environment. You wouldn't be able to just put your hand on a coconut tree and just rip off the entire bark because the plants are so stressed and sick. They're sickly. The very same thing that Dane Wigington talks about in his world. Well, if the plants are all becoming more and more sickly, how does that affect us? Now, you talk to Joe Sixpack, who's completely oblivious to these things, or people who would never watch your show, they don't care. They don't have the consciousness to care. But really, what's more important? That, you know, that you live on a planet where everything around you is in the process of dying. It's on the way to dying. And were I not a grower, maybe I wouldn't be as conscious of it. So when you say, do I reconsider? Yeah, I reconsider. I reconsider all the time, but I guess it's a part of me that's just not a defeatist. I can't look at a universe where I do see design intelligence. I do see intelligent design and say all this was designed with the purpose to see how quickly a group of psychopaths can destroy it all. I mean, just speaking intuitively, does that sound to you like how the story should end? Does that appeal to your sense of justice and natural law? It doesn't appeal to mine.
Well, it occurs to me that a story about POWs and Vietnamese camps, those who had really strong faith in religion, had overwhelmingly higher survival rates than those who believed in nothing, right? And the key there was hope. When you're locked away in a cell with absolutely no chance of rescue, you're going to be there and the war's been going on for 10 years. You have no idea whether or not you're going to get out. If you believe in something, on the other hand, you're not alone in that cell and you're not beyond getting rescued. But if you believe in nothing, you absolutely are, and your body will shut down and die as a result. Ergo, I think in the modern world, a lot of the times that we see these bad things, denial seems to be the first response that people have. And I would argue that in some cases, denial is indeed a healthy response to a lot of the problems that we deal with every day. However, when you're in denial of absolute reality, like this is the absolute reality, there's no escaping it. Denial ain't going to help you then. All right, the only thing that's going to really help you then is acceptance and getting something done about it. Because as a man, I like to look at things practically, and I see a problem, I'm going to come up with a solution, you know, that kind of thing. A lot of people are like that. And a lot of other people are more like, oh, you've got a problem? I don't want to hear about it. Just tell me the solution so I don't have to worry about there ever being a problem. And then I'll be able to solve it without ever understanding what that problem is, which is the dumbest thing you could possibly do.
Well, I see something deeper to this. You mentioned hope or people having religious belief. You know, when Viktor Frankl wrote his book, Man's Search for Meaning, this was a guy who was in Auschwitz. And a lot of people don't know that only one person out of 22 that went into that camp ever came out alive. So being a psychiatrist with a very long pedigree and being an inquiring mind, Frankl wanted to know what separated the people who survived Auschwitz versus those who threw in the towel and just gave up. And what he found was those people who felt that their life had meaning, had purpose. I was not born into this world to die in a concentration camp. My life has meaning. I'm here for a purpose. And what I'm here to tell you is that if you expand that concept to the level of the divine, if you believe that we do better when we are guided by a sense of purpose, not just hope, you can hope for anything, but a sense of purpose, that your life has meaning, that you came here with a purpose, you agreed to these things probably before you incarnated, that you're doing something that no other human being on this earth is equipped to do as well as you are. And when you have that as your guiding light, that becomes the seed planted to build a better world. And if you expand the concept to believe that if we are microcosms of whoever it is that created us, and we are best guided by purpose, then on the level of the divine, there must be a purpose for what seems in the current moment to us on our level of consciousness as being purely insane. And it, we have to have a belief in that purpose. So somehow what comes out of this is some learning experience about the nature between light and complete lack of light, between the light and the dark. I have to believe that. I have to believe that my creator is no less imbued with a sense of purpose than I am.
Well, and this is where depression comes from, and that's why a lot of people are killing themselves. Left, right, and center today. I actually read a stat somewhere that other than the American medical system, suicide is the number one cause of death in America. You know, more than car accidents, more than anything else, right? And it occurs to me that, well, not only is there a psychotropic drug sort of thing in there, but the reason why people get depressed is because they don't see a benefit to tomorrow, more or less. They only have faith in the sun when it's up.
Well,
and so they don't live through the night.
I get into this latest book I've written called Living on the Precipice. I talk about extensively about René Dubos' concept of maladaptation. The reason you have so many people depressed, depression is an issue, suicide is one of the leading causes of death, is because we have created so many different artificial constructs, whether it's GMO foods, drugs based on this idea that we need to invent Frankensteinian molecular structures that exist nowhere else in the universe and expect it to the body to act as if they're natural substances, to EM pollution and all the effects of smart meters and G5 electric cell towers, et cetera, et cetera. The human mind in attaining to a healthy and maintaining a healthy state, when you subject it to all these forms of maladaptation, things that it doesn't know how to deal with, it doesn't know how to allow them to adapt to normal human life, that creates stress. That stress produces depression, and given enough depression, yes, you're going to have people that commit suicide, and it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse before it gets better. You're going to have people even more depressed. You're going to have people even with more pharmaceutical drugs, because they're with Codex and everything else they're doing, they're trying to basically outlaw everything that comes from the natural world that they can get away from, that they can get away with. You know, it's funny, you know, down here, both here in Ecuador, up to 20 grams, and in Uruguay, marijuana is legal. Yeah, I can go visit friends in Montanita on the coast, and I can't walk down the street without smelling marijuana. The whole idea that people could have accepted this idea that the government is going to go out and start making individual plants illegal. It's like, where do you guys get the balls to just start going out and nilly-willy start telling me what plants I'm allowed to congregate with and what plants I have to avoid? What gives you that right? It's insane. But people don't think of it as insane because they've been living with the insanity for so long that the passage of time has given them an idea that this is okay, this is acceptable. It's not acceptable. So
it's the definition between a religion and a cult is that a religion's been around longer. And essentially, that's the same belief in the badness of cannabis, is it's just become a religion.
So, you know, this is where we're at, that when you governments, and I make this point very strongly in the book, because of the fact that they maximize entropy, they live on negaprosity, the gifts that come from negative reciprocity, from where they suck the life out of anything and everyone to gain advantage over not only their own citizens but other governments, that carries on long enough, it's only inevitable that governments have to, by design, openly declare war on the natural world. They cannot do otherwise. Structurally, mind you, structurally, governments will always be in a state of war with the natural world. So when they get together and you hear about this Paris Accord and all this other healthy course crap about how we're going to do this and we're going to you know, do good things for climate change, it's not possible. It's just all rubbish, because they themselves are the initiators of the process and maintainers of processes that maintain an open declaration of war on the natural world. How can you maintain an open declaration of war on the natural world and say that you're going to do something about climate? You're going to really? You're going to make the world a better place for us when you're going to destroy the world with one hand, and with the other hand, you're going to tell us about all the nice, wonderful things you're doing to make the planet a healthier place to live? Yeah, right. You know, this, unless people... go ahead.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is why I love marketing. Continue. That's how they do it.
Yeah. So... you know, we have to be able to look beyond the veneer of the posturing the governments do to try to make themselves look like something that they're not. One of the things I do in my book is because of the fact that I've dealt extensively with cancer patients for most of the 28 years my wife and I have known each other, governments have an incredible, incredible similarity to cancer. How they cloak themselves, how they hide themselves from the immune system and try to protect themselves, how they put out on the cellular level messages that are the complete opposite of what they're doing. It's incredible, and ultimately how they work to the detriment of their host and end up killing the host. Government, by its nature, on a social level, government is cancer. And to accept government as normal is to accept the idea to have your body completely metastasized with cancer all over it is a normal way for a human body to live. That's what you have to believe if you think government is just so cool and just so bitchin', that you have to believe that a human being completely with metastasized cancer all through the body, that that's a normal state for a human to live.
You just imagine somebody going down to the beach, taking their shirt off, covered in tumors and stuff. And then somebody comes and like, oh, what lovely tumors. You've been working on those for a while, honey, you know.
Oh, you must be a socialist.
Oh, man. So, you know, this was trying to put some things in place so that people could put things in perspective. And, they better do it sooner than later because we're kind of running out of time. We really are. On a planetary level, we are running out of time.
Yeah. As they say in Fight Club, this is your life, ladies and gentlemen, and it's ending 1 minute at a time. Now, the word came up to me, word came to mind when you were speaking about this, when you look at government as cancer, and the word was Mandelbrot. All right, and those of you who don't know what a Mandelbrot is, it's a hologram that you zoom into, and as soon as you zoom into on one part of it, you realize it starts to repeat the initial hologram that you were zooming into. You zoom into it again, and it starts repeating the pattern again. That's a Mandelbrot. And it seems to me that government being cancer is very much like that. On a microscopic level, you've got cancer metastasizing and spreading and killing and destroying. And then on the upside of the scale, if you zoom into the hologram, zoom out of the hologram a little bit further, you see the exact same process replicated in government form. Now, here's an important realization, though. The reason why cancer and indeed aging even happens is for the same reason why metal rusts. Oxidation. What's it caused by? It's caused by free radicals. These are these things that steal electrons, right? Now, what stops that from happening is antioxidants. Antioxidants are these seemingly benevolent little organisms that come in and they donate their electrons to your cells so that your cells can remain healthy and keep going along. And I thought of this in a Mandelbrot sort of the version, whoa, that's psychopathy and activism, right? Psychopathy is the free radical that comes in, steals electrons, and promotes cell degradation, the running down of health, the dying of old age, and that kind of thing, and all the health problems. And then you have activists on the other one here who donate their energy in order to restore that level of health, whether it be on a number of different scales. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're out there, the human race's natural defense against these kind of against these kind of free radical scum. You know, I thought that was a pretty interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's one way of looking at it. By the way, it's funny. We here on the ranch, we make our own liposomed vitamin C using lecithin and astaxanthin. Pretty incredible what it does. You really feel the effects of, because of the fact we now know we're being exposed to all this additional radiation, not to even mention the fact that even at our altitude, we're experiencing the effects of Fukushima. I get in that into an article that I wrote back in 2015. But nonetheless, it's a good analogy. And so on the cellular level, we have to view each of us as individual cells. On the cellular level, we have to fight this, even if it only means the co-creation within the mind of a better world. You know, the Shuari here, we have several indigenous groups that I work with regularly. It's just a natural part of my work because they're the best herbalists in the jungle, is the indigenous peoples. The Shuari have a saying here, the world is as you dream it. The world is as you dream it. And what's happened is, the dream of the psychopaths to create a lifeless world, to create a world of Earth that's completely sterilized, they've simply applied more vigor to their dream of the world than we have. And we have to change that because there are more of us than there are of them. We have to use the powers of co-creation, which begin in the mind, because thoughts are things. Thoughts are things. We have to use our minds to work together to reinvigorate, to create a healthy planet. But our vision of what this world should be needs to be more intense and more vigorously applied than our opponents, who think that it's just so damn cool to create a lifeless world.
It's problematic as well, because when you go after these kind of people, psychopaths, and I've had personal experience on this, they do not go willingly, and they become much, much worse before they do.
Oh, sure
go,
they do.
If they
sure
go
they
at
do.
All.
Mm. Sure they do, but they can't control our thoughts. They may think they can, but they're not going to be able to control our thoughts. We have the ability to use the mind to create, to co-create something better. I really believe that. And I think that, or at least is the word that I'm getting, that trickles down to me, a lot of these people that supposedly are in high places of power, they're having to seriously rethink what they've done. Don't think that there aren't people, that there are people who are members of the elite, the ones that are maybe the least psychopathic in the group, who are saying to themselves, what in the hell are we doing? Do we really want to, is it really worth this collective, is it really worth having this collective suicide pact just so that we can have a few extra years of extra money and extra goodies and extra power? Does that really make sense? I think there's people in high place and power who are beginning to at least ask the question. I'm not saying that they have the answers, but I think they're asking the question.
Well, my question is, then, can you trust a psychopath? Like, a psychopath comes out and says, I'm against psychopathy. Can you trust them? Because he's inherently against himself. And the reason I ask is because I'm a narcissist against narcissistic psychopaths. And the reason why I keep saying I'm a narcissist is not only because I am, but because the knowledge of what somebody is gives you an insight into what their behavior is going to be. Now, a psychopath who's dangerous and what have you won't tell you they're a psychopath.
It does, ultimately, it doesn't matter what they think, because there are certain forces in the universe that seek equilibrium. And when something is this far out of equilibrium, I think there are forces that come into play that have not hitherto been self-evident. I don't think you can be this far out of equilibrium without calling upon certain natural forces in the universe. To restore health where you've got a complete runaway disease.
And
so ultimately, we can't get too absorbed in what they're going to do and what they're not going to do, and whether there's any element to reform themselves, because obviously if past is prologue, there's not a lot of reason to have faith that they're going to reform anything. But there are forces in this universe that are considerably more powerful than they are.
So let's think about that, because Alfred Labrémont Weber has called you the new American philosopher. And I've got a number of friends who do CE5, like Close Encounter group meditations and things like that. And the amount of stuff that they've captured and gotten me to edit the videos for them using night vision, using infrared, stuff that just shouldn't be there is there, right? And
I'm going to tell you something that will shock
you. Interacting with them.
I'll tell you something that's shocking. As you know, I live at 10,000 feet in the Andes Mountains. I live way into an area that is called the Cajas. Cajas is Spanish for boxes. It's a description of this natural park that we have here. It's called the Cajas Parque Nacional. And it's very high up. It's very remote. I live in an area where you've got more cows than you do people. And I'm here to tell you that there's no such thing as a clear sky where I live where you don't see UFOs. I lived in the United States for 50 years, and never once did I see a UFO. And if I were to judge things based on my personal experience, it would have been easy for me to say, I didn't, but it would have been easy for me to say, I think people who think UFOs exist are crackpots. Why do I think that? I never saw one. Lo and behold, I come down here, never seen a UFO in my life, and I end up settling in a place where it is not possible not to see a UFO as long as the sky is clear. Obviously, I don't see them when it's an overcast sky, and right now we're in the middle of the rain. We have a dry season and a rainy season. We're kind of in our monsoon right now. So there's a lot of nights right now where I don't see them. But if it's a clear sky, there's no night where I don't see UFOs. And I have lived, we've lived here since 2008, and they're increasing in number. And I got a neighbor in here, brother, that got freaked out. He's got one of those, you know, those military flashlights where it's like a laser beam, you know. So he thought he'd get cute. He thought he'd be cute, and he thought he'd shine one on one of those UFOs. Thinking, you know, he was laughing about it, and he shined one on it. The thing came toward him and then sped off, and he just about went back into his house and peed his pants. He couldn't believe it. No, there are other intelligences who are increasing their involvement in human affairs, building up to something. Now, what that something is, I have no, that I don't know. Although I speculate, like I say in the book, The Gospel of 2012 According to Ayahuasca. But nonetheless, it seems to be that there is an increasing interest on the part of outside parties in the affairs of what goes on this planet. I doubt these various entities are in cahoots with the government. I would find that very difficult to believe. I think they're very disturbed. I think what we've done with nuclear energy, I think that what we do here on this planet reverberates and have an effect throughout the cosmos. And I think there are beings out there more intelligent than ourselves that realize that if you view your, let's say that you view your galaxy as a body and each of the solar systems in it as individual cells, that there is a value in being vigilant about an extremely unhealthy place in your galaxy. This is my own view. And this has become an extremely
unhealthy place. It might be an infection. You know, yeah. It might infect the rest of the galaxy.
Yeah. And, I hearken back to that book written in 1858, Atomic Suicide by Walter Russell. And basically, this is a guy who entered cosmic consciousness in 1922 and was a very prolific polyglot, prolific throughout his life. And he basically said, if you guys keep fooling around with these nuclear power plants, you're going to kill us all. You're going to kill everything on the planet. Now, try to keep in mind, he wrote this in 1958. And what has happened since he wrote that? He warned us. Of course, we ignored all of his warnings. And we've created a situation where all these leaking power plants, and they're never going to tell you. They're never going to tell you just how big the problem is. They're always going to marginalize it, minimize it, call you a conspiracy theorist when you make it an issue. But in his world, on the periodic table of elements, uranium, plutonium, these very, very heavy-weighted metals, they are the destroyers. There's a small concentration of them in large rocks, and eventually those rocks turn into sand, and sand turns into soil, and soil creates the foundation upon which life, plants can grow. They're the destroyers. So one thing you don't want to do is take the elements that have a useful function in the universe. They are the elements that are the Shiva. They are the destroyers. One thing you don't want to do is you don't want to concentrate them in one place. And what do you do when you build a power plant? This was Walter Russell's warning to us. You don't take the destroyers and concentrate them in one place, because you're going to get to a point where you're not going to be able to control them. And you've got a situation where the nuclear waste from these plants is worse than the atomic weaponry.
It's only the most dangerous stuff ever developed by man. I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Why would you concentrate them in one place? This is the point that he made. And this is kind of reflected too. You know, everybody is, you know, you'll remember, you know, Albert Einstein was confronted with, you know, this is what we're going to do to generate power. Isn't this a really cool idea? And Albert Einstein's response was, you know, that's a pretty bizarre way to boil water. Yeah. So this is what we've done. And this is only one tiny segment of everything that we're doing to move in the direction of creating the conditions that support lifelessness on the planet. So,
It reminds me, the reason why they called it plutonium after Pluto, the Roman god of the underworld.
Yeah.
You know, it's in the name, ladies and gentlemen.
just go ahead.
Don't fucking mess with it.
So go ahead and just keep concentrating on that and building larger and larger, store inventories. Create larger and larger inventories of these destroyer elements so that they can escape and destroy the world at large. I mean, you know, I am struck by how Russell's admonitions in the 50s were ignored and how much what he said was happening is happening before our eyes.
Cheap energy.
And I was, you know, what's funny, you know, the guy that developed the word Gaia, Sir James Lovelock, right?
Also, it was a guy who did that. I'm surprised.
Yeah, he coined the term Gaia, which is used quite frequently now, and when people are actually talking about planetary health, and the guy is out there, and he's a big cheerleader for all the great benefits of nuclear power.
It's a funny old world.
This is unbelievable. This would be like trying to imagine, you know, the Pope, residing over these large, you know, Luciferian rituals. Well, forget I said that. That's already happening. But anyways,
it's the same freaking thing. I mean, like, we don't live on Gaia. We live in opposite town, you know? Like, everything is what it isn't and nothing is what it is. It's madness, right? And a whole lot of people go, oh, the world's so crazy. The world's so crazy. And I'm like, well, did it occur to you that it might be getting run by crazy people? You know? Just think about it for a second. If something looks crazy, think of something that might be responsible for that. Possibly a crazy person. Huh?
We're back to structural analysis, because when you have government, when you have that structure in place, you will create a magnet for psychopaths. It's inevitable. It's all in the structure. Again, it goes right back to structure. When you have government, you create a magnet for psychopaths, and you will attract the worst elements of your society to be in positions of power.
Could you create a structure that's repellent to psychopaths? Like they look at the structure of this company or whatever, and they go and back away from it.
No, there's no changing what it is. Just like you can't change a spoon. A spoon is a spoon, and government is government, and you can't change it. But what we can do is the thing that our governments can't control is our ability to network together and to co-create, to work together, to imagine, you know, it's, these people who quote the Bible all the time, the chapter of Matthew begins when the Word was made flesh. The Word meaning thought. Creation comes from, at the divine level, creation is the result of thought. Well, we have some of those abilities ourselves. They've just been atrophied from lack of use. But we have the ability to use our thoughts to create. We have the power to create. Maybe not in the same fashion as the creator of this universe, but we, each of us, have the ability to create. And thought is the seed from which creation begins. And when we start imagining a world that is healthy, that is free of psychopaths, that is free of government, because structurally it can only bring about more psychopathocracy, then we will begin to reverse course. But until we do that with a greater fervor and an energy and a sense of dedication, then the people that are committed to making this planet lifeless, we won't see significant, palpable progress. That's my view.
So it means that nobody's really going to just come and save us. We have to save ourselves.
But we could use a helping hand. And I think that's probable at this point. I don't think that we're going to be able to do it all ourselves. I think we'll need a, you know, we're 200 feet off the bow of the Titanic and we're trying to get to one of the lifeboats. And we can swim in the cold water for a while, but I think we're going to end up getting a, we're going to get a hand to help pull us into the boat.
Well, you can only really be helped if you help yourselves. It's kind of like a nutritionist that I was talking to before. He never takes on a client if they say, I want to lose weight. Never. He only takes on clients who says, I want to be healthy. And all right. So thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Support the show at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And my guest has been Greg Gaddon. See you later, ladies and gentlemen.
Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our stringent quality controls and absolute zero GMOs plus testing for heavy metals makes us unique in the storable foods market. Our line of fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Take out the amount you need and reseal the package for use within the next 6 months. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's www.simplycleanfoods.net today.
American Survival Wholesale is a proud sponsor of the American Freedom Radio. And when you purchase quality products from AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com, you help support this program. Our quality non-GMO foods do not contain MSG, high fructose corn syrup, or heavy metals. At American Survival Wholesale, you can choose from over 8,000 quality products, including self-defense weapons, bug-out bags, and long-term storable food at wholesale prices. We also have custom food packs available, including gluten-free, dairy-free, and vegetarian packs. If we don't have it, you don't need it. American Survival Wholesale is a veteran-owned and operated company which also supports our veterans in need, and we are very active in disaster relief. If you would like to become a distributor, please email us at bugoutamerica@usa.com or call 818-720-0759. We offer free consultations to answer all your questions. Do it today while things are calm. That's AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com.
And when we're not invading some sovereign nation or setting it on fire from the air, which is more fun for our Nintendo pilot, then we're usually declaring war on something here at home. You ever notice that about us? We love to declare war on things here in America. Anything we don't like about ourselves, we declare war on it. We don't do anything about it. We just declare war on it. It's the only metaphor we have in our public discourse for solving problems, declaring war. We have to declare a war on everything. We have a war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice? We got no war on homelessness. Huh? No war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. No money to be made off of the homeless. If you could find a solution, if you could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of million dollars each, you'd see the streets of America begin to clear up pretty quick. I'll guarantee you that. I will guarantee you that.
I'm telling you.
You gotta support American Freedom Radio, because this government is getting out of hand. Wall Street won't loan them my money. The CIA are cutting into my drug running and my gun running. Big Pharma's psychotropic drugs are making my customers commit suicide before my hitmen can even whack them. And then they get depressed and get prescribed psychotropic drugs and commit suicide too. They're trying to become the biggest game in town. When you pay them protection money, you don't even get protected. I got unpaid taxes, and if I can't find the money, the IRS are gonna take my thumbs. I got a mandatory flu vaccine, and now I'm autistic. I reported a vaccine reaction, and the doctor told me to forget about it. What have I ever done to have them treat me so disrespectfully? There's only one way to get the government off our backs, and that's to support American Freedom Radio. Capiche? So what are you gonna do? You're gonna go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and give them some legal tender they can't refuse.
Launching sequence initiated. We're now in the approach phase. Everything looking good. Need to remove the old route. Prepare your mind to experience American Freedom Radio.